John Donne wrote most of his holy sonnets between the years 1609 and 1614. That is, after 1598, when he converted from Roman Catholicism to Anglicanism, and before 1615, when he was ordained as an Anglican priest. As a recent Protestant convert to Anglicanism's Calvinistic theology, he was in the process of understanding that salvation results from God's gracious work in the heart of the believer, not from a Christian's performance of such religious works as going to confession, doing penance, saying so many Hail Marys. But apparently Donne found that he was not naturally receptive to God's gracious action in the heart. While Jesus may have said in Revelation 3:20 that he stood at the door of our hearts and knocked, waiting patiently for us to open the door to him, the speaker in Holy Sonnet 14 feels incapable of performing even that apparently simple action. He claims that he needs the full power of God's grace. If he is going to be saved, he says, then all three members of the Godhead itself must force open the door and enter without being invited. To develop this meditative prayer, Donne relies upon four prominent rhetorical strategies. The first is his use of the Petrarchan sonnet form, whose rhyme scheme organizes the thought of the poem naturally into 8 lines, the octave, and 6 lines, the sestet. In the octave, the speaker describes his spiritual predicament, that is, his inability to save himself. In the sestet, he nevertheless proclaims his love for God and his willingness to accept whatever is necessary to restore him to a faithful relationship with God. The second rhetorical strategy is the language of force that the speaker uses, heightened by the alliterative use of B sounds, as in the words batter, break, blow, burn. Because the speaker is incapable of doing anything to save himself, he urges the entire Godhead to focus its power to take control of him, whether with his will or against it. The third rhetorical device is the use of simile and submerged metaphor in describing the relationship of the speaker to the Godhead. In the octave, the speaker describes himself by using the simile of the unfaithful city, one that legally belongs to God, but one that has been usurped, that is, taken illegally, by another power who is God's enemy, as we learn in line 10. God gave the city a deputy named Reason to prevent a takeover by the devil, but even this deputy has proved unfaithful, untrue to God. And thus far, the Godhead has not been sufficiently active to reclaim its own town. The Father has only knocked at the gate. The Spirit has only breathed on the citizens. The Son has only been shining upon them. The speaker instead begs the Godhead to batter down the gates of the city by breaking, not knocking, blowing, not breathing, burning, not shining. The city doesn't need to be mended, it needs to be rebuilt from the ground up. The contrast between the actions in line 2 and those in line 4 are exact and complete. The submerged metaphor occurs in the sestet, where the speaker implies through his choice of language that he has been God's unfaithful lover. Even though he is now betrothed to God's enemy, he claims that he has continued to love God and would gladly be loved in return. Again, the only way this love relationship can be restored is by some forceful action on the part of the rightful husband, God himself. So in line 11, the speaker implores God to divorce me from the devil, untie or break that marriage knot that joins me to him. The last significant rhetorical device that Donne uses throughout the poem is paradox, that is, statements that are apparently self-contradictory. Scripture is full of paradoxical statements describing the inversion brought about by conversion. For instance, the first will be last, said Jesus, and when I am weak, then I am strong, said Paul. In Holy Sonnet 14, the speaker draws a similar conclusion. Only when God has overthrown the city will it rise and stand, line 3. This paradoxical truth becomes most intense in the last two lines of the sestet. Only when God has enthralled or enslaved his unfaithful city will the speaker be free, line 12. Only when God has ravished his unfaithful lover, overwhelming the speaker by force in a kind of divine rape, will the speaker ever be chaste, line 14. These shocking paradoxes betray the intensity of the speaker's need, even his desire for God's tough love. Perhaps in this moment of confessed weakness, the speaker is exhibiting his greatest strength. He is, in short, praying, "Not my will, but yours be done." And he is making himself most vulnerable and paradoxically most faithful when he, in effect, says to God, "Do whatever it takes to make me yours."